So I would be very happy to have questions from you guys along the way when we're giving lectures, so just shout them out as we go. What I'll talk about is techniques for amplitudes and effective field theory. So let's first talk about what effective field theory is. So when you learn about quantum field theory, you learn about field theory, Lagrangians. And if we started with scalars, you would have kinetic terms. You might have some interactions, like phi cubed. You would have some, like phi to the 4. We could have Maxwell fields, like we just heard about in Nick's lectures. They could couple to the scalars. And for example, we could have some complex scalars in the game. Kinetic term, and then to couple them with a Maxwell field, we want to make this a covariant derivative. And then we could have terms that would couple 5 scalars to each other, or 6 scalars to each other, or couple scalars that have derivative interactions. We could couple things to fermions, to vectors, phi f squared, like we saw about with the axions, and so on. Now, normally, when you learn about quantum field theory, you often stop here, because these are the renormalizable interactions. And in everything I'll do, I'll be in 4 dimensions in these lectures. That's not particularly special to what I'll say, that we're in 4 dimensions, but I'll just restrict to that to keep it simple. And so we write down the standard model. We write down all the things that we learn about and the standard model beyond the standard model and all this stuff. And then we often said, OK, these are non-renormalizable couplings. And you can ask then, are these useful to think about? And the answer is that they're very, very useful. And they're useful in the following sense, that what makes these ones different from the ones in the renormalizable part is that the couplings up here either have dimension of mass, or they have massless coupling constants. But these ones here, all these ones here, have couplings of negative mass dimensions. And you could work that out by saying that what you should have is an action that is dimensionless. And in natural units, then, that require all these couplings here to have negative mass dimension. But that also means that if I look at the effective coupling, and I make it dimensionless in terms of the energy scale or whatever is going on in this theory, then the effective coupling will scale with energy. So for example, if I picked, just as an example, this phi to the 4 term and call this coupling G4, then the dimensionless coupling that this would have would be something where I put in, say, the center of mass energy of some scattering process that involved this interaction, E. Then this would be the dimension coupling, dimensionless coupling. And one thing you immediately notice about is that if we're at low energy, this thing is small. So that's the key point, small at low energy. And the same is true for all these non-renormalizable interactions, is that when you write them in terms of dimensionless couplings, the effective couplings, then they get smaller with low energy. And as such, we should include them in things that we think about as low energy effective actions. And so low energy effective actions, a low energy effective field theory. And that is the EFT that I put up in the title. So theories where I regard them at low energy, I should only really consider them up to some effective UV scale, but in which this coupling that they effectively couple with is going to be small. So what do we know about effective field theories? What is one nice example that you have of an effective field theory? Example number 0 is a theory that you're all familiar with, namely Einstein gravity. So general relativity has an action, which we often write as 1 over 16 pi g. And the 4x square root g r. And the Ricci scalar that appears here, this is the Einstein-Hilbert action, the Ricci scalar that appears here involves terms that have two derivatives acting on the metric. And as such, to make this whole quantity dimensionless, it must be that the Noether's coupling that we have here has dimensions of inverse mass squared. And so it has negative mass dimension. And the effective coupling of this thing is something with e squared g is the effective coupling. And at low energies, this thing is small. And we all know that gr in our low energy world is a very nice theory for describing the gravitational phenomena that we see in the solar system. And all the effects that you know from gr from both scales of our solar system and beyond in the universe. So from this point of view, gr is an effective field theory. And we also know from our observations that as such, it's a very good theory. But where do we expect it to break down? Well, we expect it to break down at the Planck scale. So it's a very good effective field theory, valid at scales much less than, say, the Planck scale.
Wouldn't it be the opposite?
Wouldn't
it be the opposite, or am I missing something?
What?
Like it would be valid bigger than the Planck mass?
No, much, much less than the Planck mass.
Okay.
Right, so I want it to be a low energy.
Oh, yeah.
At low energy, yeah. So this is the scale set by the Planck scale, and I want it to be not valid above that, but at low energies affected. Very good. Okay, let's explore some other EFT. This was one where I thought I wouldn't have to work too hard to convince you that it's a useful theory. When we come to scalar theories, you have just heard about axions, so maybe I don't have to work too hard either. But let's think about scalar theories also as effective field theories. So let's imagine that we have what I will call my UV theory. So it's going to be a nice renormalizable theory where I have a massless scalar, little phi, and then capital phi is some field that has mass capital M. And in this theory, I'll assume that these two fields interact with each other through a term that quadratically couples the little massless phi to the massive capital phi. So just one cubic interaction. And we can call this coupling of this thing G. So let's suppose that I want to scatter the little phi massless particles. So I want to compute the scattering of two phis to two phis, the little ones. And since this is the only interaction, the only way they can do it is via an interaction with the massive scalar. And so I have to write diagrams that has the fat line in between. This is the massive scalar. And then I have the massless ones on the outside. And I will write plus permutations because I have to do this according to the Feynman rules in all possible ways of writing these diagrams. And then when we compute this, the Feynman rule from each vertex is g up to constants that we're not going to worry about. And so I can write down my overall amplitude in the following way. It's going to be somewhere you have a propagator, which is the massive particle. And then the permutations will give us all these different terms. And by S and T and U here, I mean the Mandelstam variables that I get from taking the four vectors in combinations P1 plus P2 squared, Lorentz invariant squared. And T is the same thing, but P1 and P3 squared. And then U is P1 plus P4 squared. And by momentum conservation and the on-shellness of each of these particles, then there's the only Lorentz invariant quantities that this thing can depend on. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so this is your quantum field theory class in review. So I have this. Now what if I imagine that I want to look at this theory in a
aren't T and U with a minus sign?
So you can define these with a minus sign too. There are some different conventions that you can use, and also depending on your metric convention, whether you're mostly plus or mostly minus. So for now, let's just define them as this. And that also, you know, that would change which sign you have in between here in the terms. Yeah. So for us here, being on shell for the particle inside means S is equal to M squared. Right. Okay, so now let's imagine that we look at energy scales where we have that M squared is very large. Of course, just saying that some dimension full quantity is very large doesn't quite make sense. So what I would mean is that it's very large compared to S and T and U. So compared with S, T and U. And that means that I can do an expansion of each of these terms in small s over m squared, t over m squared, and u over m squared. And so that means that my scattering amplitude then becomes first the term in which I neglect the kinematic behavior, s and t and u. And I see I will add up three terms that are all m squared and get 3g squared over m squared. Okay, that was the leading term. The next term, I'll pick up the expansion here of the geometric series that is linear in S, T, and U. And so I will get something that is G squared S plus T plus U divided by M to the fourth. And one thing that we know about these phi particles was that they're massless. And so they have a rule that says that this quantity S plus T plus U will add up to zero. By momentum conservation. And so that actually means that this term is absent. Oops. All right, well, let's continue. So we get a term that is g squared over m to the 6, s squared plus t squared plus u squared. We'll get another term, which is and here I'm neglecting some of the couplings that you will see, but it's not so important what exactly they are. But you get this, and of course then we can just sort of continue along the way that this is what you get. Okay, so effectively this now looks like there are only polynomial terms in S, T, and U. And I can ask if there is some Lagrangian I can write down that will reproduce this directly. So the Lagrangian here we had for the UV theory had just this interaction. It gives us these pole terms. But now we expand it at low energy, and we want to know what this action looks like. So what is the low energy EFT that we get for this, okay, that results from this theory? So if I forget about all these terms over here, and I just look at the leading constant term, this has no momentum or energy dependence whatsoever. It's just a constant. And we already know which theory gives a constant. That would be an interaction which is?
Fermi.
What, sorry?
Fermi.
It's kind of like a Fermi interaction, but for scalars. So it's really just a phi to the 4. So if I look at this interaction here, so my EFT interaction, that would be a phi to the 4, which has 3 g squared over m squared as the coupling, times 1 over 4 factorial, times little phi to the 4. That would just reproduce exactly such a constant term. Now, this guy was 0, so let's jump ahead to the next one. Well, it's something that has a coupling that goes with g squared over m to the 6. But now we see that this term here is something that is order p to the 4. So where do we get p's from in the Lagrangian?
Derivatives.
From derivatives. OK, so this is something that must have 4 phi's because it's a 4-5 interaction. And it also must have 4 derivatives. So let's write that schematically as d4 phi to the 4. So there'll be something like this. I'm not saying that these are all self-contracted. They're distributed in some way on the scalars, but we'll schematically write it like this. And then there can be some number that makes sure that we get the correct coupling. And then for the next one, we can start writing down. This would be g squared m to the 8. And now we need 6 derivatives because this term here is order p to the 6. And then one has to figure out how to arrange these derivatives on the scalar fields in such a way that we get the correct interaction here. Plus, of course, dot, 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 dot. And there are some combinatorial factors that will appear in front of these terms, but these are just going to be some pure numbers, just like we had the 1 over 4 factorial here. So basically what happened was that this diagram here, which we call a pole diagram because it resolves in terms that has poles, becomes local contact term interactions. So this means that we go from diagrams that look like this to diagrams that look like that, where this captures the interaction terms in this set of interactions. And in principle, we could do the same thing at higher point. 6-point interactions and so on would in principle also be there if we computed 6-particle amplitudes. So in general, we could think about this type of theory in this class as a scalar effective theory where we have, and I hear I should have said these were only the interaction terms. So I have my low energy effective action with a quadratic term like this, some B0 coupling times phi to the 4. That could in principle also be phi cubed, but let's not ignore that for now. Then I have something with the 4 derivatives on it. I have something with 3 derivatives on it. Sorry, 6 derivatives on it. And so on. And then, of course, also terms that have higher order fields in it for the higher point interactions. Okay, so far so good. The rules of effective field theory says that if I don't know the UV theory as I did in this case, my rule is that I have to write down all these different effective interaction terms up to a certain order. And I have to include them with coefficients that could in principle be anything, any number, in terms of some scale that controls the UV physics. So let's write down the sort of EFT rule, which is that you must include all higher derivative interaction terms. And often I'll have to say higher derivative many times, so I'll abbreviate it with HD. So I must include all higher derivative interactions. That are allowed by the symmetries. With completely general couplings. And those couplings are often also called the Wilson coefficients of the effective action. Wilson coefficients. And in this particular case that we looked at, where our low energy effective theory came from this particular UV theory in our example, we saw that B0 was 3g squared divided by m squared times 1 over 4 factorial. Our B2 was proportional up to some number times g squared over m squared. if you do the combinatorics all right, then one way you would write it would be 1 over 4. That's actually what the value would be in this case. Maybe I should carefully put that in. Right there. Okay, so these are the particular values that we got in this case. And in terms of the scale, which sets the scale of this negative mass dimension operators, what we have is that these are otherwise just some numbers. And what we notice in this particular case is that B0, B2, B4, etc. in our action were all positive numbers. That's what came out here. The sixth derivative in action has a positive coefficient. And that all just arose from the fact that we were expanding out something that is a geometric series. So 1 plus x plus x squared, etc., etc. That's just how this came about. But in general, we should, if we didn't know where this theory would come from and we just look at this low energy effective action, there's no reason to expect that these coefficients would have to be just positive. They could, in principle, be any numbers. They could be positive, they could be negative, they could take any values in terms of the scale of the UV physics, though perhaps you might want to build in some sort of naturalness says that it shouldn't be like a million times the scale of the UV physics, it should be sort of an order one number. So this is similar to saying that they could have these action interactions, but the coupling has to be very small. Then you have to explain why that coupling has to be very small in your model. I have a question.
About the term with B3, is it like delta 6 pi to the
power? Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should have called this. Yeah, we can call it B3. I should call this B3 too. Sorry, this one, sorry, was? This is still phi to the 4 for this one. It's because I only extracted things about the 4-point scattering amplitude, nothing about the 5 scalar amplitude. In fact, in this particular model that we wrote down, there wouldn't be any terms with phi to the 5 because we have a symmetry that sends phi to minus 5, and that has to be respected also in the low energy theory. So there couldn't be any odd point interactions in that case, but in a general theory, there could. Those could be ones that would not be allowed if I wanted to have a symmetry, but if I didn't know about that symmetry, I would have to include them. Yes?
Yeah, so these coefficients can have any value a priori, so that any complex value, right?
I would say in this case here, we were dealing with a real scalar, and I would want my theory to overall be a real number, so these should be real numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're pure numbers, but in terms we learned that this is dimensionless in 4 dimensions, but these ones have negative mass dimension. So there is some scale of the UV physics that sets the scale of the negative mass dimension, and other than that, it could be any number.
Right.
Yes?
Something I've always wondered, like, we need to put this Lagrangian in an action like that.
Yeah.
We need to integrate like the whole space-time. If we do the transformation to momentum space, we'd have to integrate overall momentum space. But this is just valid for low energies.
No, so good. So when we compute, that's a good question. So when we compute these low energy scattering processes, at least for now, what I'm only talking about is the tree level. And it's true that you transfer yourself over to momentum space when you derive the Feynman rules. That means that you're integrating over all space to get things in a momentum representation. But you don't integrate over the momenta until you're calculating loops. Okay. Great. Other questions?
So is that on top supposed to be 5 to the 4 as well in the top
one? Ah, yes. Thank you. That was perhaps the question. This one was supposed to be 5 to the 4 also. Thank you. I got carried away with my sixes for the derivatives over there. So these were all 4-point, yeah. To learn about the 6-particle interactions, I need to compute the 6-point amplitude for that. Excellent. Okay. Well, I want to give you one more example of a theory in this class with just a real scalar. And to do so, let's jump over here. Okay, that's alive. Okay, now we lost the microphone. We'll reattach it.
That was a quantum fluctuation.
Well, it's a big one then. Yes. Okay. All right, so one more example. Is the following. So I will tell you what the name of it is. It's what's called the DBI action, Dirac von Infeld. All right. So what is this? So this is the low energy effective action on a brain in string theory. But let's try to set it up in a non-stringy language. So suppose I have flat space. So all of the blackboard, and extending out of the blackboard is flat space. And I put in a membrane here. I put in some object, which is four-dimensional and flat in this space. And imagine that I have some fifth direction here. Let's call it x5. Then before I put this object here, I had translational symmetry in this direction. By putting this object here, this flat brain, then I break the translational symmetry. And the way it's broken, you can think of as spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you know that when you break some symmetry spontaneously, you get a Goldstone mode. So because of this, you get a Goldstone mode. And that Goldstone mode, I'll call phi. It's some, because this is a bosonic symmetry, it's going to be some bosonic field. And that will basically live on this brain. And one way you can think of it is that it describes small fluctuations of this membrane in space, this high-dimensional membrane. Now, then you can ask, what is the effective action that describes this? And that effective action that describes this is given by the DBI action. And you can write it in terms of some tension. That is the tension of this object. And here I was dealing with just four dimensions. And then there's a square root of 1 minus d phi squared minus 1. One feature you notice here is that phi only appears with derivatives on it. So it has a shift symmetry that is respected. And in fact, it has the particular form of the action also implies it has an enhanced shift symmetry, which because I also break the rotational symmetries, that is induced. But that's not so important for this story. The point is just that we have this action. It's an effective action. That should come from good UB physics, because all I started with was flat space. I put a brain in. I asked, what is the low energy effective action? So this is our EFT. And I can now expand it in the low energy expansion. And I'll get terms that look like t times minus d phi squared. And that just gives me the kinetic term. And then I get plus 1/8 d phi to the 4 plus dot, dot, dot. So this is a special theory of the version that we had over here, in which the B0 was not allowed because it doesn't respect the shift symmetry I should have for the Goldstone mode. So B0 had to be 0. And the B2 that I had here was a term that is basically up to combinatorial factors, 1/8 times the tension. The tension is something that is a positive quantity. That's the one that sets the scale of the problem of this effective interaction. And again, one thing we notice about this is that this is positive.
And it's still integrated.
No, what, sorry?
The integral.
Oh, sorry, yes, I Lagrangian versus, yes, thank you. And the thing is still an integrated quantity. Thank you. Okay, so now we've seen an example, which was GR, which is something you have heard about in Donahue's lectures. And then we have looked at some particular example of a low energy theory that came from a particular UV theory. And it took this form here with the coefficients being positive. And then we've seen a third example also that had a good UV description and resulted in a positive coefficient. So perhaps the statement that I said before, that the coefficients in an EFT could be any number, positive or negative, perhaps that's not true. Or perhaps it is, because I can write down whatever I want, right? I could write it all with negative coefficients if I wanted to. Yeah.
That's B subscript 2.
Yes, that was carried away with 8, B subscript 2. Thank you. And then this was a 1 over 8. Very good. Other questions? Same thing? Good. This is all little typos put in to keep you on your toes, as the usual excuse, right? Okay. So, you know, I can write down a low energy field theory by this rule we had. I'm allowed to do anything I want. But perhaps there are some rules that I have to adhere to if my theory is supposed to come from some sensible UV physics. And the point I want to try to make in this lecture is exactly that, that when your theory comes from some sensible UV physics, as it did in these examples, then you can't actually pick these Wilson coefficients in any way you want. They have to satisfy certain constraints. Before we get there, I want to give you another example. And so this is going to be the last example of this class. And that has to do with the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian. So let's keep in mind that the world is not just the theorist's dream of scalar fields. There are also other particles, for example, photons. And if we do QED, then we have photons, and they couple to electrons and positrons. And as such, I can ask what happens if I try to scatter just photons with each other. And you say nothing happens, because photons only interact with charged particles. So that's it. You can't just scatter a photon with a photon. And then I say, oh, but I can, because I can write a loop. And then I can have my photons interact like this. Sorry, these are my photons. So a four-photon effective interaction arises from letting my electron or my lepton here run in a loop, or any other charged particle that you want. Now, you can compute this diagram. And sometimes this is referred to as light-by-light scattering, because it scatters light with light. And if I then go and I look in a parameter space where the mass of this thing that runs in the loop is really small compared to the energy scales that I'm interested in. Sorry, it's very large compared to the energy scales I'm interested in. So I want to look at this at very low energy. Then for M large, this becomes an effective interaction. Just like we had in our scalar case here, that when this mass became very large, I could expand out, and I got some effective local interactions instead. The same thing happens here. But the type of theory that you get now will have something with photons. And the gauge invariant quantity that we can use for photons is the field strength. So whatever I have to build my interactions out of has to be the field strength, not the gauge potential itself. So these local interactions, local EFT interactions, must be built from the field strength of the Maxwell field. And the smallest thing I can do that has all the Lorentz indices contracted would just be F contracted with itself, F squared. But I know that doesn't give me an interaction term. That gives me the kinetic term for the Maxwell field. So then I could try to contract three different ones. And then it turns out that if you try to contract F cubed, then if it's a non-abelian, if it's an abelian field like the Maxwell field here, that is basically a total derivative. If it's non-abelian, you can have it, and we may come to that later. But for now, it's a Maxwell field, and so you can have F cubed. And so the smallest thing you could possibly have is something that is of order F to the 4. That's the lowest dimensional thing you get. And that's, in fact, by even dimensional arguments, what you get out of exactly looking at this one loop diagram and reducing it to what you said when you get the mass very large. But there are different ways you can contract F to the 4. I can contract two Fs with each other. like in the kinetic term, and then square that. And then there's another way I could do it, which is what you saw in Nick's lecture. I can contract F with F dual, and then square that. And those are two different interaction terms, as you just saw in his lecture. This will give you something with E field squared minus B field squared squared, whereas this one will give you E dot B, all of that squared. So those are two different things, and those are basically the two only things you could make out of two vectors. Okay, so we have those two interaction terms, and now I will tell you something about what that effective action looks like in terms of those. So I will write, oops, this effective Lagrangian, which stands not for Einstein-Hilbert this time, but for Einstein, no, for Euler-Heisenberg. And it has our kinetic term for the Maxwell field. And then it has some coupling, G1, and I'll normalize it in terms of the fine structure constant, whatever controls these vertices will be square root alpha for every one vertex. So this goes as alpha squared divided by 90, which is conventional, times m squared, where m squared is, m is whatever the mass of the thing that runs in the loop. OK, so that multiplies our f squared squared. And then there's going to be a similar term, g alpha squared, divided by 90 m squared, just to normalize the same way, times f, f dual squared. OK, very good. Now, what are the values of g1 and g2? Yeah?
Two questions. So first, what about the term that contracts all four together?
Ah.
Is this also total zero?
So the term that contracts all four together is a linear combination of those two other things.
Okay.
It's not different from that.
And the second question, why
yes.
m squared, not m to the 4, I would expect 4 powers of
that. So, yes, naively you will have something that from this loop would have 4 powers in there, but you still have to do the integration.
Mm-hmm.
And let me think. Should it be m to the 4? Naively it should be m to the 4. So I'll check this for after the break. I'll tentatively write m to the Is it? Does anybody remember? Okay, somebody look it up. What goes here? M to the 4, you look up Einstein, Euler-Heisenberg, and make sure that we get the dimensions right here.
It's M to the 4.
M to the 4, very good. We should be able to know. Good, thank you. Excellent, M to the 4. That makes more sense, also on dimensional grounds. All right, very good. So M to the 4, thank you for that. Then the question is, what are the values of G1 and G2? So the mass of particle that runs, it could be a fermion, which was what we had in mind when I said QED, so electron positron, for example. And if I do that, then the value of G1, I pick this normalization so that this is 1, and 2 is 7 over 4. Okay, so those are just those values. I could also thought about scalar QED. So if this thing that ran in the loop was a scalar instead, then I would get 7 over 16 and 1 over 16 for these two constants. I could even imagine some kind of vector version of QED, where the thing that these photons couple to was some charged vectors, charged massive vectors, and then you get some funnier numbers that you can look up in the literature. I'll put a reference in the notes. And what you notice for all these is that it's very clear that exactly what you get in the effective field theory depends on what your UV theory was. Yes?
So is alpha the fine structure constant here?
Yeah, so alpha is the fine structure constant. It's whatever in these different theories controls the interactions between the photon and M. And of course, if I had the scalar version, then the interaction wouldn't look exactly like this. It would be more something that looked like that. But it's the same type of story. I integrate out the massive thing in whatever that theory is. Okay, very good. All right. Yes?
Can I build F4 by multiplying F2 if I have to work?
Sorry, could you do what?
So if
I multiplied f squared with f of dual, it would be parity odd. And that I wouldn't generate from this in particular. But in general, if I didn't know anything about where it came from and wrote down an effective field theory, I should perhaps also include parity odd terms, unless I had reason to believe that that shouldn't contribute. Okay. Now, I could also imagine that I had a theory where I had all sorts of combinations of these things in there. But I can't add a spectrum in a negative way. So for a general theory that had fermion scalars and vectors coupled to the photon, I would get positive linear combinations of these for each of the ones. I couldn't get anything with negative ones. I will have this number of fermions times this number of the scalars times this number of the vectors, but those number of particles I would have would also be all positive. So in general, in these type of models, of UME models, we'd get positive linear combinations of those numbers. And that then in particular implies that G1 and G2 are both going to be some positive numbers. Okay, so now again, we had an example where we had some UV theory, be it scalar QED or regular QED, and then we look at the low energy effective action for it, and somehow we're always finding that these coefficients should be positive. So one goal is to try to understand why in the world that seems to be the case in all these so-called UV-complete models. And even then, if that is true, then can we even learn more about restrictions among coefficients, such as these ones in effective field theories? Yep.
Yeah, and these are, because we have to renormalize this loop, right?
So that's a different question. Renormalizing it is a different question, yes. Good, but yes, ask. Yes.
Well, just these numbers, they are scheme independent, right? When we renormalize mass, alpha, right?
So one thing that you could think about is what do you have to do when your couplings run? And one of the assumptions that we'll make throughout is that whatever it is, this alpha quantity here is that it's so small that it's only the leading order contribution that will matter. And anything that renormalizes the couplings further would be then higher power in alpha. So that would appear here, possibly with logarithms and so on from the renormalization with the normalization scale. But we assume that our alpha is small enough that we can neglect such things. So there's going to be a weak coupling assumption throughout that neglects those. But it's a very interesting question, what happens when you don't have that? And that's only been partially explored in the literature. Well, it's a very, very relevant question. Okay, wonderful. Other questions? Okay, now extracting such positivity constraints has different names. And so depending on maybe the authors, just like people have their favorite metric conventions, people call these things different things. But this basic idea is essentially all the same. So let's try to summarize what we have seen so far. We have observed some positivity properties. Positivity properties are Wilson coefficients. And extracting such constraints goes under the name of statements like S-matrix bootstrap, which also means other things to different people. They could also mean actually bootstrapping the amplitudes itself from basic mathematical properties, which is part of their story. There are words that are called the EFT hedron, which I'll explain more about, which is in some sense adding a geometric interpretation to these type of positivity bounds. Some people just call it positivity, which is a nice positive way to look at the world. And then if you want to go more fancy, you could call it dispersive constraints. And there are probably other ways of calling it too. So why do we care? I mean, so in what I will talk about, I'll talk about examples in this class of scalar field theories, because that's just the simplest context. And one of the reasons we care is, from a formal theory perspective, is that this whole idea that at low energy I'm allowed to do anything I want, it's very interesting that you can map out and put constraints on the space of allowed theories, assuming that they come from some good UV physics. We'll talk about what good means, but this is basically a way of constraining the possible space, constraining the possible space of effective field theories. And that in itself is very interesting. To try to understand why in all these examples do we always get positive coefficients. There must be some underlying reason when you see it in so many examples. And for example, you might also ask if you can bootstrap down interesting theories more concretely. For example, some of you might like string theory, some of you might not. Some of you might not care. But what if we could show that under very basic assumptions at low energy, string theory was the only way of, say, computing Yang-Mills theory with high derivatives? That there is something that picks out the particular Wilson coefficient that string theory would give that you otherwise couldn't. And so that is one formal theory interest, is can you bootstrap, and to what extent can you bootstrap string theory in these contexts? Or in other ways limit what you can possibly have. And from a phenol point of view, this is also interested, but with certain caveat that it's a little hard to see how you can make it relevant experimentally, because these constraints often involve numbers that go to much higher orders than you can experimentally test at this stage. So you have to convince your phenol friends strongly why this is interested, and it has to really be explored more. So the idea is that perhaps measuring or putting bounds on, measuring / bounding a few EFT coefficients may heavily bound other ones. So in principle may restrict the values of others. Values of others, and similar to explorations that involve EFTs in cosmology and so on, that could also potentially be bounds. All right, so what is the goal of what we're doing here? The first goal is to try to give some introduction to the part of the amplitude program that is needed to put in some constraints like this, and then to show you how to derive positivity bounds. So next, we'll use a brief intro to some modern amplitude methods. And then apply it to, let me just call it one name, to EFT hedron, and give you some of the simplest bounds that you can derive in this way. And we'll see how far we get. So any questions at this point? All right. Okay. So far, in all these examples, I appeal to Feynman rules. And Feynman rules are great. You might hear in other talks on amplitude methods that forget about Feynman rules, they're too complicated. But Feynman rules are really great. They're very generally applicable. You can use them to scatter scalars, fermions, vectors, gravitons, whatever you want to do. There's, in principle, a logical setup for how to do it that's systematic. And of course, you do it when you take QFT classes. You compute all these two-in, two-out processes, local terms we've seen. But one of the things that you don't often do in a quantum field theory class is compute, say, two gluons in, four gluons out with Feynman rules. And the reason is just when you compute two gluons to two gluons, it's pretty simple. You have a set of diagrams, you can compute them, you can simplify them, you can find the answer. When you're doing two to three, it's a little worse, but if you had a mean professor, they might give it to you as your homework, and even meaner as your exam. But you know, two to six is just not even fun and not very enlightening. There are just so many diagrams. And I think one thing that is often clearly communicated in quantum field theory classes is higher loops are hard. You learn to calculate one loop classes in a year-long course, and you're like, oh yeah, that was bad enough. I have to renormalize, I have to put in epsilons in all sorts of places, but I could do it. Then why about two loops? How many calculated two loop diagrams? You calculate in QFT class?
I mean, as an example, but we never did an exam.
Okay, you didn't have an exam. That you should be probably grateful for. So two loops is okay. Two loops, okay. Three loops, four loops, five loops. It's getting very, very specialized, and it's usually never done with Feynman rules because it just gets hilariously complicated. What is often underappreciated is that even at tree level, a process that involves six gluons is also very, very difficult because the number of diagrams really explodes. It grows combinatorially with the number of particles involved. Plus, each of the mathematical expressions you extract for each diagram is just really complicated. So even if you can, and you can, of course, get a computer to just write down what it is, sum up all the diagrams, you'll end up with some expression that is not very interesting. You know, what are we going to do with it? It's just some complicated mess. And you can evaluate it numerically, but you know, then so what? So the idea is that Feynman rules are great, .. but get complicated when you work at high multiplicity. Multiplicity and or both at the same time. High loops. And so one of the goals of the modern amplitude methods is to try to avoid getting into all the details of Feynman rules, all the issues of gauge fixing, all the ambiguities of how you fix your gauge and the field redefinitions you can do in your actions, and simply write down the answer based on what you know about the mathematical properties of the amplitudes. And so I will try to give an introduction to that. These type of methods of the write down the answer, because this is what it must be, up to some unknown constants in these lectures. And I'll focus on doing it for scalar theory simply because that's the simplest. Then we don't have to deal with polarizations and fermion wave functions and all that stuff. But in principle, everything I say can also be used in those cases. And then also, we're going to use the scalar methods when we deal with these questions of positivity. Okay, so let's dive in by looking at a simple example that you have almost seen already. So let's look at an example where we have phi cubed interactions and phi to the four interactions. And this field phi will be massless. Okay, so it almost doesn't get any simpler than this. So what can we possibly learn? Well, let's see. So I write down the tree amplitude. And by now we know that we have diagrams of this sort here, plus permutations thereof, 1, 2, 3, 4, plus a four-particle interactions from phi to the 4. And so I can write down what the answer is. It's g squared from the two couplings at cubic order divided by, and I'll denote this now, s12, and g squared s13, and g squared s14, where my s's, just like before, the Lorentz invariant contractions of the energy momentum vectors that we have. Okay, and then we have the local term, and let's call the coupling of that some lambda. Okay, and why did I write squared that? That was to see if anybody yelled at me, because it shouldn't be there, of course. Now, in general, these things we call pole terms, because they have poles. And these terms are often called local terms, or we would call them contact terms. And what contact terms have in common is that they don't have poles. And that is true in any theory that come from some local theory, where you can't have interactions that go as one over box or something like that. You don't have that, so this comes from local interactions and their contact terms. We also see an example of contact terms that were polynomial in the Mandelstam variables. Okay, so I'll often use this language that looking at the pole terms and looking at the contact terms. So what do we notice about these amplitudes? So it came from some, we're assuming that it came from some Lorentz invariant theory. And so that Lorentz invariance buys us that this thing can only depend on Lorentz invariant contractions of things. In this case, the only things that are there are things that come from the momenta, the derivatives in the kinetic terms. So they must only depend that A n depends on Lorentz invariant quantities such as, in this case, Sij's. Okay, so that is one clear observation from this. And then the other observation is, as we just noticed, this thing can have poles. But in each of these poles, they can only be simple poles, because the poles correspond exactly to where you can exchange a physical particle. And as you know from the propagators, those only include p squares in the denominator. And so for that reason, we can only generate things that are simple poles. And by the way, let me emphasize that we'll focus entirely on tree level until we also include loops. Okay, so they can only include simple poles, and these poles are not allowed to be partially overlapping. No partial overlapping poles. So for example, something that has 1 over S12, S13 would not be allowed, because you could never write down a Feynman diagram that had this. This is not allowed. And this is partially overlapping in the sense that they share line 1, but not 2 and 3. So it's partially overlapping. And you can see that there's never a Feynman rule that I could write down that would have this thing for a momentum in the internal line at both of them. But what is allowed one thing that is allowed is a term that could be like 1, S2, S1, 2, 3, where they're completely overlapping in the sense that the momentum that runs on this is included in that. And that would come from a diagram, say, that looks like this, where this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this would be P1 plus P2 running here. And what runs here would be P1 plus P2 plus P3. And so that can arise, so fully overlapping or contained in one or the other, but never something like this. Okay. And that's just thinking about what diagrams can arise. But it's important to know what are the things that you're supposed to have in your amplitude. And then a third property is the following. That has to do with, now that we have established that there are only simple poles, then what are the residues on those simple poles? So amplitudes factorize amplitudes factorize on the simple poles. Into products of lower point on shell amplitudes. What does this mean? Well, let's take our amplitude here as the prototype example. So I have my A4 tree, and it has a pole in the S12 channel. So let me compute what the residue is of this amplitude at S12 equal to 0. So technically what I would say is take the limit of S12 going to 0 of S12 times A4 tree. And I see the only thing that survives is the g squared up here, this guy. Well, that was pretty simple in this case. But I can also see that what this thing is, it's the same as the free particle amplitudes multiplied with each other, because each of these are just g.
Sorry.
Yes?
So when we say these are simple poles, formally, are we putting all the sort of Mandelstam variables in the complex plane at the same time, or are we just sort of...
Ah, good. So you could think about it this way. So one thing I could think about is that in this case here, I only have two free parameters, in a sense. And then they're even... I have to have these guys sum up to zero. Okay, so I don't really have three different variables. And then I could look and say just the S-plane. I can think about it that way. So when we want to use complex analysis and think about the true residue, we can think about it this way. But I get to choose which kinematics plane I want to be in, depending on which residue I pick out. So I can repeat this exact thing for the S-channel. I can repeat it for T-channel, U-channel, for higher point amplitudes. I can go in every one plane I want. And the factorization has to happen there.
Good question.
Yeah.
Is that rule that amplitudes factorize in this way related to the optical theorem?
So the optical theorem is usually, it's sort of a tree-level version of this. The optical theorem is usually what happens when you have something like a loop, and you cut it, and you relate that. So this square, you can relate to the discontinuity associated with that. And that is, it's somewhat relevant for some of the things we're doing later. But this is sort of a tree-level version of it. It's much more simple. It just really says that every time I have a simple pole, it has to come from this lower point. And when I go on that pole, this line goes on shell. And then what this result has to be is the product of these two on-shell amplitudes. There was a different question. So, yeah.
So that factorization, is that is there a proof for that, or is it just a rule?
It's basically a property of unitarity, you can say. So, from the point of view of Feynman rules, for scalars at least, it's sort of fairly obvious what has to happen in this case. For vectors, it's a little more complicated, but you can still prove it by essentially inserting a complete set of states in between. So you can think about it in the matrix element language that you have some in and out states. So some initial, some final state. And then you could insert a complete set of state in between and factorize it into that. But you have to have... For these to be on-shell amplitudes, the thing that goes in between has to be on-shell. So you have to look at that particular kinematic point in that region to go there.
Oh.
Yeah?
Sorry, another question.
Yes.
If we do this, we break it, we put it on-shell.
Yes.
And we have two states here, one state.
Yeah.
And massless.
They're all massless,
yeah. On-shell,
Because
yes.
If you go to the center of momentum reference frame, then your last state is a massless.
Ah, very good, very good. Okay. So one of the things that we often do is we allow ourselves to let the momenta go into the complex plane. And so we will often even talk about that, thinking about each of these variables being allowed to lie in the complex plane. And you're exactly right that one of the things that we learned perhaps at some point is that a massless particle cannot decay to two other massless particles kinematically. And that's true in real momenta. And so we often allow ourselves the freedom to go into complex momenta. So this is not, I mean, for a scalar, it's fine. But for example, for photons, you can't do it. So I'm skipping a lot of little details here. But this basic spirit is that from Feynman diagrams, we know that you get the pole diagrams from the ones where you can exchange a particle in the spectrum, a particle from the spectrum of the theory. And then it has to be somehow that when you go in the kinematic place where it splits up this way, it has to factorize. And also, because I said you have to really insert all the physical spectra, in general, you could have a sum here. If I had more different particles that could be exchanged here, I'd have to sum over them all and get the sum over the factorized amplitudes. Okay, we're going to see a little bit more about how it works to reconstruct amplitudes without worrying about Feynman rules. And so let me give you an example of this. So okay. So one more thing is that anything that goes in the category. Okay, so let's think about it this way. Now if I want to reconstruct an amplitude, I have two parts I need to focus on. One is where it can have poles, and then I can reconstruct those terms from knowing the lower point amplitudes using this factorization. But then there will also another part, which are the contact terms. And here the contact term was very simple. It was just a constant. But we saw other cases where they were proportional to s squared plus t squared plus u squared and so on. And so what you have to do there is that in general, contact terms are polynomial in the Sijs for scalar theories. And here I should say local scalar theories, so there are no weird interactions, but anything that what we have seen in these general contexts of d phi to the 4 and so on. Okay. And if we had other fields, like photons and fermions, these polynomial terms would still be polynomial terms, but they would be polynomial terms in contractions, not just of momenta, but also with polarization vectors and fermion wave functions and so on. Okay, so the contact terms are polynomial, and they also have to respect whatever symmetries that we deal with. So let's look at an example of how this works. Okay, so as an example, let's think about an interaction that has four derivatives on phi to the 4, okay, some way. So the Feynman rules tell us, of course, that the derivative corresponds to momentum. And so if I were to read off the Feynman rule of this interaction, then I would say, OK, if I really expand this out in this way, it would look something like this. And so what I will get is contractions of momenta. Yes?
Yeah, which metric signature are we using here?
I'm being casual with my metric signature, so you can use your own favorite ones. I don't want to keep track, really, of the I's and the signs,
okay,
because that is so dependent on what you want to do.
Right.
So I think that gets too detailed to worry about right now. But of course, it matters for exactly how the signs appears in Lagrangians and so on.
Right.
Okay. So the contribution that you would get here from Feynman rules would be contractions, P1 dot P2. And then for the other particles, P3 dotted in with P4. I should change my index. Plus all permutations thereof, because there's nothing special about phi. It's all, you have to look at all the different ones that you get. And so that's the Feynman rule. Now if I take it on shell, then I notice that PI, or let's just P1 say, P1 mu, P2 mu is the same as 1 half P1 plus P2 squared minus 1 half P1 squared minus 1 half P2 squared. That's true whether or not we're on shell, but on shell, the squared terms will vanish because I have massless particles. So that means that every one of these dot products that I get in the Feynman rules, I can convert to this type of expression. And so this in particular becomes S12. And now I can then see that my on-shell amplitude at 4-point will be some number, which is whatever the coupling of this thing is. Let's call it G4 for now, times S squared, S12 squared. Wait, let's do it one intermediate step. S12 times S34. Yes, we can put in the 1 half. And this I should put in the 1 half too. Thank you. OK. So here I should put a 1 quarter if we do it like this. OK, so then we put in that plus all permutations. But by momentum conservation, S12 is the same as S34. And therefore, I can rewrite this whole thing as S12 squared plus S13 squared plus S14 squared. And that's exactly this S squared plus T squared plus U squared expression that we just wrote down earlier when we look at the low energy expansion of the UV theory. And so how could I have known this to begin with without doing, now I did Feynman rules, which I just said I didn't want to do. I did it anyway to illustrate where these expressions come from. But how could I have known? The reason I could have known was that the interaction that I have here, I know is something that is order p to the fourth. There are four derivatives, so it must be p to the four. It involves four particles. I know that the only Lorentz invariant variables that I have would be S12, S13, and S14. Everything else is related to that by momentum conservation. And these also, of course, have to sum to zero. So what is the thing I can possibly do? I know that I have to have something that is bosymmetric. And it must be something that is quadratic in these variables and permutation symmetric in all the external labels. And then there's only one thing you can write down, and that is this one here. So this has the correct Bose symmetry. And it's also correctly order p to the fourth. And at this order, there's just only one polynomial. So without worrying about any factors and combinatorial factors and doing my math right and all my i's and minuses, I can just say this 4-point amplitude is some Copley constant times this polynomial.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I was lost in one point.
Yeah, good.
How was this canceled, or the from 1/4 to 1/2?
How, this one?
No. The last line.
This line?
Yeah, we had this 1/4.
Very good. So one of the things is I have all permutations here. So I'll also have a term that says S34, S12.
Oh, great.
And that will take care of it on the momentum conservation. Very good. Great. Of course, I mean, it all depends how I then wrote down my Feynman rule, if I also took that into account. But again, what I want to emphasize is that as I parameterize this theory without worrying about the Lagrangian, I don't really care about this number. I'll call it my G4. So whatever is here is going to be my G4, and I just write down the answer. Yep.
Is what you call Bose symmetry here the same as crossing symmetry?
It's not quite the same as crossing symmetry. What I just mean here is that if I think about my amplitude, my 4-point amplitude, and I pick all my lines to, let's say they're all outgoing. So I've used crossing symmetry to make them all outgoing. Then the answer has to be permutation symmetric in all the labels, because there's nothing that distinguishes the order in these interactions.
Sorry, another question.
Yeah, good.
I want to understand this. Why, for example, 1/4 and 2/3 would be the same if we're summing?
1/4.
If we let the having one minus the order.
So 1/4 is equal to 2/3 by momentum conservation. Like that. So my momentum conservation in these conventions where everybody goes out is that all my momenta has to sum, all four momenta has to sum to zero. So that's what makes them be all the same. Good. Okay, now you can see the idea of how do I go to, for example, deal with an interaction with six derivatives on here. It has to be order p to the 6. It has to be a polynomial in these terms. I write down all my fully permutation symmetric polynomials at that order, of which there's only one, namely the one where these are all cubed. And then when you get to high enough order, you have to be careful because then there can be more than one. But that's a very systematic way of writing down all the interactions that you could possibly have with some thing, with some interaction. And then that can write down all my four particle amplitudes with any number of derivatives on them like this, in this way. Okay, now what's the deal? Well, you say that is all fine. You can then use these methods to just write down all your four particle interactions. But I learned in quantum field theory class that I have to use my proper off-shelf Feynman rules to calculate higher point amplitudes. So don't you need these Feynman rules, the proper Feynman rules, to calculate, say, the six particle amplitude with such two vertices? So let's look at this. What happens at 6 point? Where I have diagrams that look like this. And these interactions that sit here are all the ones that come from d phi to the 4. So in order to get that answer correct, it would seem that I needed something where I could at most have three lines on shell, and the internal line I should have properly off shell so I can contract it. So I definitely need to know more, it would seem, than just this rule here. Otherwise, maybe I would get the answer wrong. So my answer here is that you actually don't need that, but you have to take care of an ambiguity that arises when I put together four-point amplitudes on shell to create the correct pole structure. And I can do that by parameterizing local terms. So let me show you how that works. So let's write down this diagram. So the momentum that runs here is what I will call P1, 2, 3. So that's P1 plus P2 plus P3. So whatever I know this is, I mean, I have to have this diagram plus, of course, all permutations of this one. But I know that when I go on the pole, where this internal momentum goes on shell, and this internal momentum I'll call S1, 2, 3. When that thing goes on shell, then this should factorize into the two four-point diagrams that I've already computed. So then the residue on that pole should be at A4, 1, 2, 3, and then P1, 2, 3, going on the inside. And then another four particle amplitude, which would be 4, 5, 6, and then this momentum, 1, 2, 3, also by momentum conservation. So it's basically saying that it has to be this part times that part as I take the internal momentum on shell. So far, so good? Okay, all right. So now I say that's great because I already know what these things are. Up to this Copley constant that I can pull out and call G4. And let's be working in conventions. We can use the conventions we had before. So I pick 1/4 there for the 1/2 squared. Then this will be S12 plus S12 squared plus S13 squared plus S, well, it should be 1/4. But by momentum conservation, that would be the same as 2, 3. So I said 2, 3 to avoid having to deal with this P inside. And then the other one, similarly, would be S4, 5 squared plus S4, 6 squared plus S5, 6 squared. Sorry, it was not A. This was just multiplied by this thing. Right. So given that I know what the residue is, I will also know that there is a term in my six-point amplitude that has that residue. So I will know I will know that my 6-point amplitude has a term that says 1/4 g4 squared s12 squared plus s23 squared, like that, s45 squared plus s46 squared plus s56 squared divided by s123. Okay, I know that this must be the pole term, and then I also know that I have to add all permutations of this one in labels 1 up to 6. So that takes care of all my pole terms. But what could have gone wrong in this compared to using Feynman rules with one leg properly on off shelf?
There might be non-pole terms.
There could be non-pole terms. There's nothing that could go wrong in actually the residue, because I constructed that correct. But when I, for example, used the Bose symmetry here, that assumes, as we looked at the Feynman rule here, that we were on shell, so that 1, 2, and 3, 4, S1, 2, and S3, 4 were actually the same thing. That required all the momentum to be on shell. And one thing, if I write this, I'm strictly not at the pole, because then this would be 0. I'm actually just a little bit away from it. And then I could have made a mistake, because then that would mean that one of my legs was not properly on shell. And that could have affected an ambiguity in this answer. But that ambiguity has to go away when p123 squared is 0. So the ambiguity that we could have, the ambiguity that we could have had is that in each of these terms, there could have been something with a number times p123 squared. And likewise, in this one, p123 squared could have come in as an ambiguity. Of course, p123 squared is the same as the s123. So that ambiguity that would have been in here with the alpha and the beta, some numbers I don't know, that would be canceled by this term and create something that is polynomial in the momenta. So plus polynomial terms that would have to be order p to the 6, because I have 4 powers of momenta there, of s there, 1 at the bottom. So that's a total of 3 powers of Mandelstams. Each Mandelstam is order p squared, so that's order p to the 6. And so I can write this down. I'll get the pole terms correct. But then I have to add in all the polynomial terms at order p to the 6 with arbitrary coefficients in order to take into account my potential mistake in using on-shell rules to get the pole right. And this just illustrates the general example of how we create amplitudes without worrying about Lagrangians. You make sure you get your pole terms right. And then any ambiguity in that, you shovel into local polynomial terms, which a priori has arbitrary coefficients. Question?
Do we capture those overlapping ones with this argument?
Oh, the overlapping ones?
Yeah.
So when I capture the overlapping ones and things that have more than one factor in the denominator, I have to be a little more careful. So what I would do in a 5-point case like this is, first, I would take into account all the diagrams that have two poles and make sure I get the factorization right on all those. Next, I look at diagrams that may have only one pole but some local term from 4-point in there. And I have to be worried that this 4-point amplitude that this would factor into on shell would contain poles from over here, and that would overcount them. So by constructing first the ones with the maximal number of poles, overlapping poles, I can construct those first. Then I have to carefully subtract those off from that factorization and then proceed systematically until my only ambiguity sits in the local terms. You can do this with various techniques, but that's in general the idea. You have to be careful about overlaps in the poles so you don't double them up. Great question. Other questions? OK, the polynomial terms we can construct because we have this recipe from over here, wherever it went. We had a recipe for constructing the local terms that just said that we have to make them fully Bose symmetric. I should pull this up so that we can They have to be both symmetric polynomials in the SIJs. And I'll finish by just saying today how we do this. So I know I need the p to the 6, but let's just start systematically with p lower order and derivatives. So 0 derivatives and 6 phis. I know that the only thing this can be is a constant because it's just a phi to the 6 interaction. What about phi squared, derivative squared acting on 6 phis? It has to be linear in the Mandelstams. And so the only thing it can be is S12 plus S213 plus dot, 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 all the different combinations. And that adds up to 17. And then I can do the ones at order 4 in momenta. There's only one thing it can be. It's the sum over I less than j of the Mandelstam squared. That is non-zero, and it could be there. And then you're like, OK, now I rock this thing. I know what this is. It's the sum over all I less than j of Sij cubed. And that's true. But there's unfortunately also another one, which is all the Sij k's cubed that you can have. And by even using momentum conservation and on chillness, these two are independent polynomials that you'd both have to include, but they're the only ones. So basically, what we have to do to compute the 6-point amplitude is I already know my 4-point coupling. So that takes care of all my pole terms. But the answer is ambiguous up to two constants that sit in the local terms. Those I may or may not be able to fix, depending on whether I have additional symmetries in the amplitudes that could allow me to fix them. Otherwise, I can only parameterize it at this and then use them in my calculations. And that's the general rule of thumb, that I try to avoid the details of the Feynman rules and simply say, what can the answer possibly be? These type of polynomials you can construct more systematically. Here I just told you the answer, but in general you have to check what they are. But it is way simpler than doing anything at Feynman rules level. OK, so I will stop here. After lunch, we'll talk about what comes after tree level. So what are the structure of loop amplitudes? We'll just briefly discuss that, and then we'll start deriving some positivity bounds. OK, all right, happy lunch.